Accession number 27811, Major Richard Wilson, Reel 10. Now, what you were talking about the composition and role of the Advance Party, yeah, that went to Wuppertal in Germany in 54, we're not quite, yeah, sure when.
Well, it would have consisted of the second-in-command, Bill Brinkler, myself, certainly somebody from the quartermaster's department, may have been the quartermaster himself, or if not, it would have been his next trap down, the Archimedes. And then there would have been, somebody from the Army Catering Corps to sort of look after that side of life, and one or two sort of administrative people, and probably similar representatives from each company, so they could take over their company blocks and all the rest of it. But I think the sort of families left, and a small advance party went up to administer them, of which I was part. And then it may well have been that there was a sort of number two lot of advance party, which would have been the company set up when we were actually taking over the barracks, because I seem to remember there was quite a long period. I mean, normally the advance party would go out 2 weeks, two or 3 weeks before, take over the barracks and all the rest of it from whoever you were taking it over from, and then the battalion would arrive. But here, I think we had there was a much longer period, and this could have well been due to politics, decisions not being able to be made, etc.
Now, what exactly does an advance party do? I mean, you have to presumably liaise closely with the unit that's leaving.
Yes, that's right. I mean, if it's under, like when we left Malaya, for example, then the Somerset's advance party really had, I suppose, two objectives. I mean, one was to take over all the accommodation and the rest of it, and then secondly was to, of course, get themselves filled in operationally as much as possible. And they would want to know, as much detail as possible about the area that they were having to operate in, the intelligence that was there, etc., etc. Moving up to Wuppertal, of course, although we were the army of, I think we were the army of occupation then, I'm not sure what we're called now, I don't think we're any longer an army of occupation, but I think we still were an army of occupation then. But our role was far more being in a normal operational infantry battalion should the Warsaw Pact attack. So from Malaya, one operational role, Trieste, another operational role, and then to Germany, where we had a totally different operational role. And if anything, I suppose you could say there it was a training very much like the fighting that had been going on in the Second World War. And we operated as a normal infantry battalions, four rifle companies.
What was the barracks like at Wuppertal?
They were excellent. The German barracks were quite excellent. I mean, again, I presume it had been built probably between the wars. Their barracks were all centrally heated, which may sound nothing today, but it was in those days. They were very well built, because we did have a pretty cold winters there. I can remember, you know, we had a lot of snow and all the rest of it, so everything was built for a sort of hard climate. But the barracks took up quite a considerable area, and the barrack blocks weren't all sort of hugger-mugger. There was a barrack block and then a nice big space and then another barrack block. They were extremely well designed, only as the Germans could do. They were very good at that sort of thing.
Now, you moved in, I presume, with not much problem then with the previous unit. I don't know who.
Yes, I can't remember actually who we took over from.
So no particular incident.
but of course, I'd been there some time when the battalion arrived, and but who we actually took over from, I don't. I can't remember. We were a brigade in Wuppertal, and in fact, the brigade commander was Dick Goodwin, who was a Suffolk Regiment officer. And we the battalion moved up, and we then got into the routine of a normal operational battalion in Germany, which of course was quite.
Can you describe that? Because it is a routine. It's a sort of training routine that goes through year after year. I think they're still doing now, you know. But
well,
one way or another.
Well, I think it first of all, I think it was a total change for the battalion, because they'd been in the Second World War, and then in 1947, I think it was, they went to Palestine, which was totally different. And then from Palestine, they went directly to Malaya. I don't think they came home. And then to Trieste. So here we are now in 1954, and the battalion really hadn't done any what I call, you know, European operational training since 1945. To a certain extent, I suppose, it was, you know, back to the drawing board. But we did, being 54, we had a lot of experience in the battalion. I mean, all the company commanders, the commanding officer, all the company sergeant majors, and a lot of the senior sergeants, etc., would have all had wartime experience. So, the main structure of the battalion were very experienced. We were, of course, still in the days of national service, so 80% of the rest of them were national service had not been in the war, and so to start normal European operational training, I suppose we must have virtually gone back to scratch and started with section training, building up to platoon training, building up to working as companies together, and then going out on battalion exercises. And here, I mean, these exercises were enormous. The biggest one that we took part in was an exercise called Battle Royal, which was a huge exercise. Virtually, I think, the whole of the British Army in Germany taking part. And so we worked, we weren't slung straight into that. We worked up to that. There would have been brigade exercises followed by divisional exercises, and Battle Royal must have been a core exercise. And it would have all been orientated towards a possible major attack by the Warsaw Pact, and that's what we were there for. Having got ourselves sort of trained in our infantry tactics, then we would go up to places like Paderborn and do training with the armor, gunners, and then of course there was, and then we would go on to live firing exercises where we used to go to Senelager. So there was a definite purpose of what we were doing, and one knew where one's aim was and where one was going. And I think on the whole, we actually worked quite hard, and certainly there weren't as number of all the sort of weekends for nipping off to Cologne or wherever it was, like it was down in Trieste, where we probably had an easier time, although possibly for the soldiers it may well have been a much more boring time than they had in Germany. But we didn't seem, I can't remember that we got an awful lot of time off, and a lot of exercises would go on for a week, 10 days or whatever it was, etc. That's really what the life of an operational battalion in.
And what were the big? What was Battle Royal like? What do you remember of
Battle
Royal?
Battle Royal was an enormous core exercise.
What did you actually do on it? Do you see what I mean? How did you fit in?
There was an enemy, who presumably was a fictitious Warsaw Pact. And of course, in those days, we had huge areas of training area, and we could also, in actual fact, because I think we were technically still an army of occupation, we could virtually take over anything that we wanted. We could go anywhere. There was nothing to stop us going over acres and acres of farmland with tanks and all the rest of it. It would become a two-phased exercise over with Battle Royal. It was over an enormous area, and of course with these exercises, an awful lot has got to be put into a reasonably short time. I mean, the brigadiers and the generals, they want to see how a battalion can maneuver itself. And here we're talking of 700 or 800 men at a time that one is sort of running around the countryside. And so one got incredibly tired. There was very little sleep. I don't know what Battle Royal was, but it was certainly a 10-day exercise. I would think it may have been longer. I can remember actually walking at dawn when I think we were going up to a start line to do a fictitious attack, actually going to sleep on my feet, walking along, and finding myself in the bottom of a ditch a minute or two later, and I'd actually gone to sleep on my feet. By the end of that exercise, we were that tired.
What means of transport did you have? I mean, were you mechanised at all by then?
We were only mechanised. I don't think we were mechanised enough with our own transport to lift ourselves. We would have to have had the RASC or to do that. So one would be lifted into one's to where the exercise started, but then after that, then there would be an awful lot on foot. We had a support company who provided us with a three inch mortar platoon, which is sort of, I suppose you could call it short range artillery. We had an anti tank platoon, which in those days was 17 pounders, and at some stage we had some things more modern called MOBATs. An assault pioneer platoon, which sort of laid mines and booby traps and dealt with the explosive side of life. And I think, I think there was one other platoon, but I shall get shot now for forgetting who they are. but we did have, you know, you did have your own little bit of sort of short range weapons, but obviously the full support would be the cavalry regiments who would have the tanks, and we did a lot of infantry sort of armor training.
How realistic was it, would you say, these big exercise like Battle Royal? How realistic was it?
I think it was probably actually quite realistic, and it certainly tested all the organizations at every level. I mean, it tested battalion headquarters, because if for 48 hours the food didn't get up to the front troops, then you had a problem. If the petrol didn't get forward to tank up the tanks of all your vehicles, there was a problem. So not only was the operational side being tested, but there was also all the administrative side under wartime conditions being tested as well. And then, of course, you were being tested right down to a sort of section level, because if you were doing, say, a dawn attack, and your orders were to cross the start line at 5 o'clock or whatever it is, if everybody or the majority get across the start line at 5 o'clock, but you manage to get there by 5:15, you've left a great possible hole in the line and can muck the whole thing up. So everybody was being tested at every level with their map reading, their tactical skills, and everything else. It was a full blown rehearsal for a possible Third World War.
Now, how much of a threat did you then, not now or in the 80s or 70s, but then in 1955-ish, you know, 4-5, see the Soviet Union or the, you know, I mean, what sort of a threat did you think they were genuinely at the time?
I think we certainly considered it was a threat. And I think, you know, everybody was still very suspicious of the Warsaw Pact, and we ourselves, of course, were lined up. I mean, you know, we had the British zone below us, we had the American zone, we had the French zone, and so here was, well, equivalent today of the European Union sizing up to the Warsaw Pact. So yes, I'm sure we considered it was a possibility, because otherwise what we were doing was all rather a waste of time.
How much of a possibility? I mean, we were sort of really expecting it to happen within 5 years or something.
Well, I'm sure there must have been an overall plan which was sort of all in the safes of every battalion headquarters, as to if the whistle was blown, where we were to go. I mean, as intelligence officer, I should remember this, but I'm sure there must have been a plan of action. If the Warsaw Pact had suddenly, I mean, presumably if they were going to attack, they'd attack about midnight, that their plot would have been to have got as far forward as possible by first light. And presumably, even then, we actually would have had some idea of forces amassing on the border. Because there was the border between the Warsaw Pact and Germany. I mean, it was a sort of wire fence with all these sentry posts and everything going from the whole way down the frontier. So and you couldn't get into East Germany, etc., without visas and all the rest of it. So there must have been, clearly there was a master plan, should the balloon go up, as to where we would go. Probably the only person who knew that would be the commanding officer.
So you didn't practice deployment.
So we didn't. I don't think we would have practiced deploying into what would be our wartime positions, because that would have been picked up if there'd been a huge exercise like Battle Royal, and we'd all gone to our deployment situation, then that would have rather given the game away. So we did the equivalent sort of thing, but not into the battle stations that we would have gone.
Now, anything else about training or exercises?
Well, we got the battalion up to a good a military pitch for operations similar to what they did in the Second World War, and it never sort of really stopped, because one was continually training, because as I say, sort of 80% of them were still national servicemen, and so there was this continual throughput, and you were having to train up, all the time. Because I can't remember when national service ended, but it was about 64 or something, I think, on that. It was that, and there was free time, of course.
What did you do in your free time then?
Personally, I enjoyed being in Germany, and I did things like, if I got a long weekend, I'd take a train down to the bottom end of the Rhine and get on a Rhine steamer and come up again to Cologne and go home, come back to barracks. The town of Wuppertal wasn't very exciting. It was down on the river. The only thing about it, it had an overhead railway, which went from one end of the town to the other. It was the sort of other way around from the underground here, but there you went above the tops of the trees. We'd go out for meals and sort of thing. And of course, leave wasn't a, when we got leave. I mean, it was very easy to get back to England again. We weren't that far away.
And as before, you not much contact with the Germans, though.
I would say very little, to be quite honest, at that stage. I mean, yes, I think we were friendly. If you went into a shop in Wuppertal, yes, we were. I don't think we caused a lot of trouble. There wasn't sort of, very much, if any, of going into German homes and things like that.
Was there any underlying hostility? I mean, the war,
No, I don't think so. I think it was long enough. I think to start with, the general population were totally fed up with war. And so they might have been fed up with soldiers, but I can't remember they ever sort of actively showed it. But I'm sure they were fed up with soldiers, and they were probably not that too happy still being an occupied power. But I can't remember that any. As you do with any battalion, you get the odd nonsense with two or three drunken soldiers causing a fracas in the street or whatever it is. But I mean, that could happen in Colchester or wherever it might be. But I can't remember feeling uncomfortable wherever I went.
Now, what was the officers' mess like? I mean, but they must have established a proper officers' mess there. What was it like, as a place to go?
Well, again, being a German buildings, the officers' messes were extremely well built. Everyone had a decent-sized room. The anterooms were very good size and all the rest of it. There would normally be a bowling alley underneath, in the cellars underneath. Can't remember whether there was in Wuppertal, certainly was in Berlin. And they were very comfortable places to live. And then, of course, on top of that, they were made comfortable for us in that we had I had a batman who sort of looked after my daily life, kept my room tidy, made my bed and all that sort of thing, and then looked after me when we were out on operations.
So he
would provide, I wouldn't have, if I was manning the ops room, I wouldn't have to worry about getting my meal or anything. I mean, he'd come along and do that. And then on top of that, we had the mess staff. There would be a mess sergeant who was responsible for the running of the mess under the president of the mess committee, who is an officer detailed by the commanding officer as to who was, and he was responsible for the everything going right in the mess and the discipline in the mess and all the rest of it. And the sergeant ran the everyday administration of it, and he probably had a corporal. And then there were a number of mess orderlies who waited at table, etc. I mean, it was good. We were well. We were very well looked after. I don't know what it's like today. I understand Batman actually is a thing of the past, but we were well, very well looked after. But I think it was important to have somebody look after your day-to-day needs when you're out on operations, because you shouldn't be worrying about your feeding and all the rest of it. At a time when you were meant to be, producing intelligence and maps and everything that one has to do when one's out on an exercise, as well. It enabled you to put 100% into the job that you were meant to be doing.